Welcome, everyone. My name is Meenoosh Shafiq, and I'm the director of the London School of Economics and Political Science. Welcome to this final public event hosted by the Conflict Research Programme. The programme is 4 years. At a job ending. Today, we're going to hear some of the conclusions of that research. We're going to hear presentations about how the logic of war and peace across 5 countries in the Middle East and Africa has evolved over the last 4 years in Somalia, South Sudan, DRC, Iraq, and Syria. The research will also demonstrate the links between extremist identity politics and the political marketplace, the role of civicness, and identifying what works in terms of external interventions in areas such as security, humanitarian need, or localized conflict resolution. We'll also hear about the high quality research published in academic journals alongside practical policy analysis relevant for the UK government and other governments interested in conflict resolution. Our colleagues will be presenting highlights from the program, examples of impact, and evidence that supports a new approach to dealing with conflict. It also comes at an incredibly important time. The work of the Conflict Research Programme has fed into the UK's Integrated Review of Security, Defence, Development and Foreign Policy, which will be announced tomorrow. Paper and the work argues that a multilateral approach of working with partners is an essential part of the UK's efforts to reduce conflict globally. But we'll hear more about that tomorrow. Now, we have a fantastic group of panelists who will be summarizing some of the research from this important program for us today. That we will hear from each of them for about 5 to 7 minutes, and then I'll ask them a few questions, and then we'll open it up to wider questions. We're going to start with Professor Mary Caldor, who's Emeritus Professor of Global Governance at the London School of Economics and Director of the Conflict Research Programme at LSE Ideas. Mary has been the motivating force behind this work, and today is the culmination of many years of hard work by Mary and others. We'll then hear from Alex Dewal, who's the Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation and Research Program Director of the Conflict Research Program. We'll then hear from Charlotte Morris, who's a Senior Conflict Advisor at the Foreign and Commonwealth and Development Office, and she has been the main counterparty in the FCDO for this work. And then finally, we'll hear from Professor Christine Bell, who is a professor of constitutional law at Edinburgh University with deep expertise in peace processes, international law, and justice. So first, let me turn to Mary, who will provide an overview of the research findings.
Thank you very much, Meenoosh. And it's rather a sad moment that we're coming to the end of the Conflict Research Programme. It's been quite a turbulent process for many reasons, but not least because we do work in the most difficult places on earth. And actually, at least 2 members of our team had to take time off because of suffering from post-traumatic stress. But just at the moment when we seem to be working very well as a team, where we seem to be coming up with findings that we want to explore further, and when we're finding clever ways to do the research in the difficult places, just at that moment, we're coming to an end. So it's a sad moment, but let's hope we'll find other ways to continue. What I thought I would do is just give you the headlines. There's lots and lots and lots to discuss, but what are the overall conclusions? And then we can discuss details at a later stage. So what are the headlines? Well, I think the first most important point is we're dealing with intractable conflicts. They're what the Americans call the forever wars. And they're not conflicts we can walk away from. We can't walk away from them because they're connected to all the global challenges we face. Transnational organized crime, illegal flows of money, terrorism, climate change, and indeed pandemics. And I actually just want to stress that COVID-19 really brings home to us the importance of addressing conflicts. In our work in our conflict zones, we find that conflicts are least able to contain the transmission of the disease. They have inadequate healthcare facilities, and they have intergenerational living, and they have many crowded places like refugee camps or prisons or detention camps where COVID spreads. And, you know, if we want to eliminate COVID, we want to prevent the emergence of new variants, we actually have to address conflicts. It's fascinating to me that in the case of polio, which was supposed to have been eliminated in 2005, it's actually reappearing in some of our conflict zones. So the first thing is we can't walk away, but the second thing is that all the classic short-term, immediate magic bullet approaches do not work. Military intervention on one side doesn't work. It just makes things worse, as we've seen in the Russian intervention in Syria and Iranian. Top-down peace talks may reach an agreement at best, but if they do, they entrench the problems that gave rise to the conflict. They lead to what Christine Bell here calls a political unsettlement, and I'll say a little bit more about that later. Humanitarian aid very often feeds the political economy of violence. So if these approaches don't work, what does work, and how do we analyze conflicts in a way to enable us to decide what works? Well, we argue in the conflict research program that the conflict has to be understood as a social condition. It's a sort of ism, like socialism or capitalism. And if we understand how that social condition works, then what we have to think about is a long-term approach to try to shift and change that social condition. So our analysis is very much focused on trying to identify the key elements that will help us understand what's going on. We argue that most of the conflicts we face are areas characterized by multiple political authorities. We usually focus on the state, but actually these are areas where the state is very fragmented, disassembled, we use the term, and all sorts of different political authorities are in operation: municipalities, regional institutions, tribal authorities, religious authorities, international institutions, which are often present. And if you understand that they're characterized by these multiple authorities, the next step to take is that each of these authorities operate on different logics. And there are some logics that contribute to war and some that contribute to peace. Now, the dominant logics in the places that we face are what we call the political marketplace, and Alex is going to talk about that some more, and exclusive extremist identity politics. The political marketplace is really about transactional politics. It's about bargaining for money, for politics. It's a kind of systemic corruption. It's not individual corruption. You can actually only enter politics if you have the money to enter politics, and you can only acquire the money through corrupt means. So even if you've got good intentions, you're sucked into the logic of the political marketplace. It's very similar to patronage systems or clientelist systems that we've observed in the past, but it's very much a product of the globalized, financialized world of the last two decades. It's very much about money. And it's very intrinsically linked to violence. Violence and money are the two mechanisms of bargaining for power. The second logic, which operates differently but tends to go hand in hand with the political marketplace, is exclusivist identity politics based on ethnic nationalism or religious sectarianism, Shia versus Sunni, Nuer versus Dinka. And the key point about this type of identity politics is that it is constructed. It isn't something that's always there. Everyone has multiple identities. When particular identities become important, it's often a consequence of extreme situations. And I think one of the most important conclusions that comes out of our studies is that identity politics is as much an outcome of violence as it is a cause. So I'm running ahead of myself. So these are the two dominant logics that are intrinsically linked to violence, and they're what reproduce violence. They produce more and more fragmentation of political authority. They depend on violence to reproduce themselves. Violence is intrinsic to the bargaining of the political marketplace. The money needed for the political marketplace is often raised through war economy methods, looting, checkpoints, smuggling. But violence is also necessary for exclusive identity politics. Exclusive identity politics depends on a situation of fear, depends on the existence of an other that people are afraid of and for which they require armed protection. And the other thing I want to say about the dominant logics is that they are profoundly gendered. They have built in patriarchal hierarchies. And actually, the gendered element itself has to be reproduced through the violence produces a kind of extreme and unstable form of masculinity that is only reproduced through further violence. So those are the dominant logics, but we then have another logic, which actually is not just a normative logic that we would like, but one that actually exists in all our conflict areas, and we call that civicness. Civicness could be described as a logic of public authority. It's public authority based on a social contract, which I know Minouche is working on. It's public authority, it's the template for most states and municipalities is a civic template. It's a template that gets subverted by the political marketplace and identity politics. But civicness is also a form of behavior. People act as if there was a civic state or a civic municipality, and we see it in the behavior of uncorrupt judges, in teachers who insist on acting inclusively, in journalists who want to tell the truth, as well as in all kinds of local acts of solidarity. And you see this everywhere. Society, people wouldn't survive without a degree of civicness, which is to be observed in our conflict areas. And finally, civicness is also a political position. In all our areas, we see political protest movements that are explicitly against both corruption and sectarianism. In Iraq, for instance, the slogan of the protesters is, "In the name of religion, they're looting us." So what we fundamentally argue is that policymakers really need to understand these logics, and the aim of any external intervention is to take these logics into account. By and large, many interventions of the kind I mentioned earlier are subverted by the dominant logics. The aim has to be to try to weaken those logics and to strengthen and support civicness. Now, that doesn't mean completely new tools. It means redesigning the tools, whether we're talking about diplomacy, the use of force, humanitarian and development assistance, and we've done lots of studies on how this might be done. But because I'm sure I'm running out of time, I only want to make one more point, which is about our methods. I think what makes us very special is that all of our teams in our five countries, South Sudan, Somalia, Congo, Iraq, and Syria, work very closely with local researchers. And I feel that's actually, not only does that give us fantastic granular information, but also I think supporting local researchers is one of the ways we support and strengthen civicness. And I can give you lots of examples of what that means. Just for example, in South Sudan and Somalia, we work with court monitors who report on court cases, which is a source of research and data for us, but which also helps to make the courts more transparent. One particular example I want to mention before I end is the Syrian database, which I really think is pioneering a new methodology for working in difficult places. The Syrian team have developed a mobile phone app, which is encrypted. And we have researchers all over Syria that upload information, both quantitative and qualitative. We have survey questions, but we also have places where they can give us reports, which gives us an incredible amount of detail on different places in Syria. I sat in a Foreign Office meeting with the Syrian team when they were explaining what was happening in Raqqa, for example, the former capital of ISIS, and how to target aid. So it's a fantastic resource, and I think it's also sort of pioneering new ways of studying conflict. Just one final
point. I'm going to
working with local researchers, but you'll love this point, Azaria, if it was Azaria, is that it raises all sorts of problematic ethical issues. And one, the Congo team have done an exhibition to show what those ethical issues is, called Silent Voices. And I do recommend you all to look at it. But also, I think one of our biggest recommendations, which we put in our submission to the Integrated Review, and I saw it in a background paper. I'll be really excited to see if it gets through, but I'm not holding my breath, which was that we need to decolonize research. And I think that's one of our most important recommendations, and I'll leave it at that.
Very good. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Mary. And I think the program has already taken some important steps through its local researchers to do precisely that. Let's turn to Alex Tewol.
Thank you very much. So let me zero in on the political marketplace and the tools that we have been developing to understand it. So the political marketplace framework, which is our analytical diagnostic lens, is designed for humanitarian civic actors in these turbulent countries and for external policymakers in pursuit of the design of peace, democracy, development, stability, institution building, et cetera. It's a descriptive tool for the logic of monetized transactional politics and a clear-eyed evaluation of the challenges and dangers facing reformers. If you like, it is a civicness-friendly version of the political operator's own handbook. It draws upon the concepts, the vocabularies used themselves by members of these political elites on their own internal vernacular assessments. So it's a lens for understanding those goals that the politicians have, their goals to gain and maintain power, the rules, the transactions that dominate formal rules-based governance, and the tactics, the bribery and the violence, both among the members of the elite and with respect to their general populations. These elements are, we find, repugnant, but we find it important to describe them very clearly so that we know what we are up against. And the basic sort of slogan, if you like, the default position is political business as usual. What we assume is that the political operators in these countries will conduct their political business as usual. And whatever they may be telling us, whatever personal integrity, whatever ideological or civic projects the political elites may have, actually the underlying logic is this political business as usual. So it builds upon a whole lot of literature, upon analyses of patrimonialism, of rentier states, on political economic analysis, on political settlements. But it is different, we contend. It focuses on turbulence and disruption, the turbulence being the week-to-week changes in the politics that come about through these routine political transactions, money and violence. Disruption being the occasional bigger changes in the overall structure that constrain the ways in which these political transactions are constructed. Let me just enumerate very briefly in a couple of minutes, seven general precepts that emerge from our research. Number one, transactional politics trumps institutional politics. Transactions, elite deals dominate formal institutions. They dominate rule-based governments, laws and regulations, and formal institutions are bent by design towards the elite tactical objectives. Number two, political finance, political budgets are central. There are two currencies, as it were. There's money and there's violence. But a transactional political system is essentially sustained over time by money. Money becomes more important than violence, though violence never disappears. And the role of money is systemic and actually relatively straightforward to understand. Concepts like political budget, the price of loyalty, etc., are concepts that are intuitively resonant in these societies. Number three, everything is political. In a political marketplace, everything becomes subordinate to tactical political calculus. If something appears to be outside politics, a technocratic institution, it's likely to be a bubble that could be burst at any time. And we can understand how political skills can keep some of these bubbles intact, but generally speaking, politicians make mistakes, they revert back into political business as usual. Number four, there is no end state. We have to get away from this idea that these countries are on some trajectory of state formation towards an institutionalized state. The current conditions of turbulence, of political unsettlement, of political market are a modern reality that will endure. And if we are, for example, trying to achieve a peace deal, don't think of the peace deal as a once in a generation political settlement. Think that it is likely to be a bargain struck in the marketplace that remains good only insofar as those market conditions remain intact. Number five, these systems resist reform. That it's extraordinarily difficult to actually reform them. You can perhaps tactically engineer short-term outcomes, but perhaps we should think more in terms of preparing the ground so that our civic counterparts can take advantage of changes when they come. Number six, these rules are actually pretty durable, and the systemic turbulence that we see does not lead to systemic change. The rules endure despite this turbulence. And lastly, one of the shortcomings, one of the points at which this analysis fails, is it assumes that the elites will always dominate and instrumentalize populations. And that doesn't always happen, thank goodness. There are instances such as civic uprisings in which these assumptions are confounded. But what is interesting, the insight that we get from the political marketplace is that the political elites and external political operators are always caught by surprise by these uprisings and their success. And one of the insights that follows on the less perhaps positive insight is that nonetheless, political business as usual tends to swing back after the success of these revolutionary transformations. Let me leave it at that, and we will move on later to questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. Let's turn to Charlotte. Oh, and you're on mute.
Thanks, Manoush. I'm going to talk a bit about how we can use the research to try and help improve our response to conflict. So I'm actually based in Oman tonight, and which has long been a bridge between Africa and the Middle East and has played an important role as a broker of peace in the region. And in order to bring about peace, we need to understand the motivations of obviously different actors in war and the ways that interventions can contribute to its end. The Conflict Research Programme was set up by LSE in 2017 with funding from the then Department for International Development. I know it's hard to recollect 2017, given it was pre-Brexit and pre-COVID, but just to recap, famine had been declared in South Sudan, with droughts across East Africa, Yemen, and Nigeria. Idlib in Syria was besieged. Al-Shabaab was resurging in Somalia. And while Iraq had declared the war with Islamic State over, the country was facing a major political crisis in its wake. In government, we wanted an independent and fresh look at the dynamics of conflict and to know whether conflict resolution initiatives were working in the face of horrendous odds. There are three main lessons from the research which have shaped our response. First, the concept of the political marketplace, examining the competitive exchange of material reward for political power, gave us a lens through which to examine the dynamics of both conflict and transitions to peace. In Somalia, looking through this prism helped our team to reshape their strategy by assessing in a new light factors such as regional access to Somalia's ports, the way that international financing was supporting Somalia's security actors, and the political marketplace risks associated with humanitarian delivery. In Iraq, a DFID team worked with the World Bank to consider how recommendations from research on the political marketplace could be implemented in practice through a new and improved economic package. And you can read the analysis of one of our economists, Alexander Hamilton, on the CRP website, which looks at how politics affect economic policymaking in Iraq. Meanwhile, in Sudan, the analysis illustrates how a shift in revenues from oil to gold fostered the conditions leading to Omar Bashir's departure in 2019 and the subsequent political transition that followed. It also indicates how in certain circumstances, lifting sanctions and encouraging economic development could further political progress. So turning to the second major finding, it's really important not to neglect local actors in favour of high-level talks and deals with armed groups. In all of the research sites, as Mary's alluded to, there are people making extraordinary progress to improve life for civilians and offer paths out of the horrors of war. Despite the difficulty in reaching nationwide deals, there has been a proliferation of local agreements and initiatives to reduce violence and keep essential supplies and services moving, often across borders. In Syria, research has shown how a platform of civil society groups from across the country contributed to the Geneva held talks in 2017. And while the talks ended without resolution, the subsequent civil society collaborations improved access for aid deliveries and solved challenges facing local communities. In South Sudan, local authorities identified famine risks 6 months earlier than the formal systems and began prioritising steps to sustain food supplies to hard-to-reach areas. And also in South Sudan, a group of academics worked across ethnic groups to ensure continuity of education throughout the civil war, and to enhance the contribution of education to building peace. Remarkably, girls' literacy rates actually increased during the Civil War. And in many contexts, we found that purely monitoring human rights and local justice decisions can improve outcomes for citizens. Our teams at the FCDO have attempted to adapt their diplomatic engagements and funding to better support these initiatives. In doing so, they found that effective support will vary as much as the initiatives themselves. In some contexts, ironically, it may be better to stand back and give local actors space. Sometimes international recognition of their work may be all that's required, while obviously on other occasions, funding will be needed to help successful initiatives to expand. We need to use our time as well as our resources carefully to determine the most politically astute approach. So thirdly, for peace to last, there need to be broad civic coalitions to overcome violent transactional politics, obviously including women. We found that lasting change comes through sustained domestic constituencies, and the CRP's forthcoming Security and Justice What Works paper illustrates how fundamental this is to post-conflict recovery. Time is often an overlooked commodity when it comes to conflict resolution. We need to use realistic timeframes, even though this can be difficult, where there is imperative to save lives and end the fighting as soon as possible. I often remind colleagues that in Sierra Leone, after the Civil War ended, our approach to security and justice included three consecutive programs funded over 9 years. This meant the approach could be tested and adjusted, and contrasts with places where projects were expected to achieve peace in a matter of months. Over the course of this research, there have been major civic movements for change in Sudan and Iraq, as well as several other countries globally. We know from the other Arab uprisings how challenging it can be for cross-party civic coalitions to transform into functioning political entities. However, there are lots of examples of how countries have overcome conflict and found pathways to recovery. Research conducted by Christine Bell at Edinburgh University, I'm sure she'll speak about it later, found that 33 large-scale conflicts have ended through negotiated settlements since the end of the Second World War, incorporating over 1,000 peace agreements. And also since the end of the Second World War, we should take heart from the fact that despite enormous challenges, over 100 countries managed complex political transitions to stability. So what have we learned? We need to understand how flows of finance, both ours and those of others, are traded in a political marketplace where actors compete violently for survival and power. We need to recognise and support those that are making a difference, where they want it, but not swamp them in funding on topics that meet our ideals rather than their realities. And lastly, we should develop 10-year approaches to conflict resolution, committing to the long haul, especially where progress looks unlikely. Hostilities will eventually end. And although the risks are high, the rewards are worth our investment. Ending conflict is important to tackling most of the global issues challenging UK national interests, whether that's terrorism, organised crime, climate change, or COVID. While resources are clearly going to be more constrained this year, Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has outlined conflict resolution as a key priority and established a new conflict directorate in the FCDO. If we can use this time to take stock and to refine our approach, drawing on the examples we've discussed today, then I'm hopeful that when the UK economy revives and our overseas aid with it, our response will be more effective as a result. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte. Thank you for that very clear set of conclusions. Let me turn to Christine.
very bad if you aim to solve conflict and you can't remember to press the mute button off always, I think. First of all, just it's a great pleasure to be here, and I'd really like to congratulate CRP on their research. I think both the scale of the ambition of the findings, which have been presented at their biggest picture level today, and also just I think their commitments in the field and the scale and the intricacy of their detailed country findings, which they haven't in ways been able to talk about, but behind these big findings, I think are also really granulated information in all of the case study sites around how these dynamics work, what sort of levers for change there are within them, and how to much better understand them. So I think there's a real value for country teams really in any international organisation or state intervening in these areas to draw on. So first of all, I think for me, what has been a really important contribution, let me just sort of draw out what I think are the contributions, and there are areas where I see CRP's work has resonance with ours. And also I think for me, I always test people's theories against conflicts that I've seen or worked on. Obviously for me, some of that's against Northern Ireland, and actually to me it's a test of CRP's research that has been conducted in really different places than Northern Ireland, but it has certainly helped me understand dynamics and label dynamics in Northern Ireland that are still ongoing 20 years after the process, where that we haven't really had a vocabulary and a name for. So understanding how literal vote buying plays a role and not just figurative vote buying, understanding how the politics continues to distort things even after an ostensibly successful political settlement. I think some of the real value in the long term of CRP research has been touched on, but the ones that I would just want to reaffirm are, first of all, I think longer term time scales for understanding these processes. And I think in common with our work, CRP work has helped also take the focus off this moment of agreement and say, look, there's a huge before and there's a huge after, and the moment of what we understand to be a big peace agreement is actually just a singular moment within a process that's deeply iterative. And in fact, as somebody who collects and documents peace agreements, sometimes I can see that the same parties have signed almost the same peace agreement 10 years apart, with perhaps complete unawareness of the international team that that's what's happened. And of course, the parties that sign the agreement then know exactly how they're going to game the outcome of the agreement. And everybody in the society knows exactly how they're going to game it. And yet sometimes international teams that tend to come and go in 3-year cycles don't. So I think CRP's work is really useful in telling people how that process occurs, how it's occurred in the countries they're working, where they overlap with case studies, and more generally, what the dynamics. But I think there's a positive story of engagement from it, because it also says, well, maybe you should look at what you're trying to create, not so much as a moment or a settlement, but as a forum through which you continue to negotiate problems, shifting them incrementally from violent problems into more peaceful ones. So if you can get things into a very, very uneasy, unsatisfactory Bosnia or Northern Ireland settlement, and none of us would love these settlements, you know, you've moved it one way. What then are the levers to move it a bit further? What are good levers and what are bad levers? So I think that idea of understanding this as an ongoing dynamic situation, and a peace settlement just slightly changes the language and the mechanisms that are in play, but some of that language and some of those mechanisms have real traction, right? So if people mouth the language of democracy, they don't become Democrats, but there's traction in at least being seen to have to name check that you're in compliance with those norms. And you do see that over and over again. We saw it actually with how the DUP were brought on board with the agreement, where they sort of were saying, well, we can't sit down with Sinn Féin until they are Democrats. But that actually led to a situation where at some point, everybody had to acknowledge that after subsequent elections, there was a democratic mandate, and then it had to be conceded to. So I think in looking at how the norms start to have traction, how that incremental process can unfold over time. What then is the international response to this? You know, how do international actors operationalize this? Well, I think that some of the sort of obvious and maybe old-fashioned sounding take-homes are that really good conflict analysis is very important, and it has to be done in collaboration with local partners, just as CRP have done. I do think there's a much bigger role could be played, and I think if there's a new conflict resolution mandate within the UK, it should seek to galvanise this, but much better international cooperation on both conflict analysis and who can, what countries and donors are best placed to respond to certain imperatives, given that all countries have their constraints and their interests. I think thirdly, really understanding that actually pro-peace constituencies are often outside of the political marketplace and trying to operate against it, and trying to operate in subtle ways to leverage change. And they often really depend on international actors to not to do it for them, but to help them exert some leverage on the situation, either by insisting they're at a table or they're at a discussion, by ensuring they have funds to operate and ensuring they've some autonomous space, some civil society space in which to operate. I think that's where UK has played a role. So these types of things I think are important. In the end of the day, all of us have moved, I think, into this sort of analysis, and FCDO have funded analysis like this out of a recognition that politics matters. And knowing that it matters, then the question becomes, how do you engage with it, particularly if you're outsiders that are never as imbued in the political situation? So I think this idea of these logics, and that the logics can reinforce each other in curious ways. You know, civicness can unpick logic of identity politics, but identity politics in certain occasions can also create forms of civicness that can then be worked on and adapted and moved. So I think what's really interesting about CRP work is actually the sort of optimistic and perverse connections between these different elements and how they work. So I just stop there by saying that I hope the CRP research does have a future life. And I certainly think the ideas, have attraction across conflicts beyond the case studies that CRP has looked at. And certainly that's where I find it really valuable.
Okay, thank you very much, Christine. I'm gonna ask two questions of the panel and ask them to respond to whichever aspect they find interesting. My two questions are, first, can state market or does it have to destroy the political marketplace in order to be an effective state? And I'm thinking in particular of, I mean, I recall when I was at DFID and we were dealing with nascent, fragile states, the argument was often the state needs to just deliver one thing to persuade citizens that it's worth supporting the state. And that one thing could be basic education or water supply or local security. And that participation in the political marketplace of being able to deliver a service that citizens values was the first step toward moving citizens' allegiance away from the political marketplace to allegiance to the state. So one question, can the state play in the marketplace, or is it better to just try and destroy it? Second question is Charlotte's point about patience and time and how long it takes to do conflict resolution and peace building, and how external actors are often very impatient. I always remember a Taliban leader who once said, "You've got watches, but we've got time." And he was basically saying, you know, we can wait you out. You'll run out of patience and you'll be out of here, and we won't. And so my question is, given all the lessons that you've learned in this research program about external actors and how the traditional approaches they've taken have failed, what are you hoping to see in tomorrow's integrated review announcement by the Prime Minister? What lessons would you like to see captured in that review? So who would like to start? Mary, do I see you, or Charlotte? Like, Charlotte, you can't really comment on the integrated review. Maybe you can.
I think I'll leave the integrated review till it comes out tomorrow, but I will comment on your first question about, you know, whether about how a state interacts with the political marketplace. I think the real challenge has been that in all the contexts we've looked at, the conflict has fundamentally been about a contest over the state that hasn't been able to be resolved. There's been a kind of standoff almost. And then as a result, lots of local entities are trying to find their own solutions during this time until a nationwide or wider deal arrives. And we've seen that they could be waiting for a very, very long time. I think what this offers is some really great examples of how those kinds of communities can still be supported during those difficult times. But fundamentally, the only way to get to an approach that looks like a sort of an institutionalized state is going to be through these long-term broad civic coalitions. And I think it's very easy to lose sight of that when everyone is just focused on trying to reach an instant deal.
Maybe I'll ask Alex to talk about his reaction on the political marketplace, and then Mary and Christine, if you don't mind reflecting on what you'd like to see tomorrow in terms of lessons learned for external actors. Alex?
I think, in the discussions that we've had with policymakers over the last few years, the question they always want to focus on is, here we have a political marketplace that is dominating, is swamping, overtaking states in these countries. Well, what is the off-ramp? And the unfortunate reality of the current era is there are many more on-ramps than off-ramps. It's actually much easier to see a state that was relatively well institutionalized, that was developing in a state-like manner, becoming more like a political marketplace. Ethiopia, the last few years being a case in point. And rather than things moving in the opposite direction. And so I think in the current circumstance where there is so much money available to be political finance for sectional, factional interests, where there's so much money around, almost every attempt to liberalize that we have seen, liberalize an authoritarian institutionalized state, results in a shift not so much to democracy but to a political marketplace. We need to rethink very much what is it that we can achieve, because we would love to get back to these institutionalized civic states, but the impulse for that is very much coming from below. I mean, citizens want that, but we are not, through our interventions, we are simply not delivering that. If anything, we are delivering the reverse. And it's a question for which we don't have easy answers. I think part of the answer will lie in the private sector, insofar as there are some private sector actors that take states away from this, particularly the mineral sector, particularly the arms sector, and the most corrupt, as we know, in any form of global business. But businesses that are involved in the more productive economy do have an interest in the rule of law, in a well-regulated, rather traditionally bourgeois state. Mm-hmm. Which leads to an interesting question that we might want to address at a later stage, which is that if we can shift, if the energy transition actually is going to fundamentally transform the nature of political economies away from the extractives, then is this an opportunity for moving over? I mean, it's not the only factor, but is this a crucial opportunity for moving away from political markets to a new form of civic institutionalized political order?
Interesting. Christine, and then our last word to Mary.
Well, I suppose in short, what I would hope for the integrated review is a kind of really focusing on the connectivity between security, defence, foreign policy, and conflict resolution. And in some senses, I think the conflict resolution solution is the one that is the kind of modality that stands to connect them. So I think the advantage of an integrated review is really looking at how the dynamics affect each other, and that when there's an intervention on any one of those spheres, that it's within a broader trajectory that's pulling the same way. Now, in some senses, you know, Mary started off by saying a version of this, but there's only, you know, conflict abroad affects security at home, and we know that, and it affects it in really complicated ways, whether it's people feeling they're acting within a global ethos, even when they're a lone wolf person with maybe a mental health problem, to tangible funding of operations abroad. I think more and more we really see the interconnectedness between what happens at home and what happens away. But we also sort of see that defense solutions and straightforward security solutions are always sort of band-aid solutions. And of course, if you can actually stop conflict, you stop a whole lot of consequential difficulties at once. And certainly it's always been interesting to me how much defense and military personnel are all often, particularly after a long conflict, often at the forefront of analysis saying, look, folks, we need a political solution here. So I hope that there is a centering on political solutions and how to leverage all the other tools that the UK has at its disposal. And it's in quite an unusual position at having very strong, you know, defence and military capability, very strong and valued international development expertise and strong diplomatic presence. So that's an amazing capacity to bring those things together. And I think there's been different attempts to do that in the past. If that's done successfully tomorrow, I think it would really centre conflict resolution and orient things around trying to stop conflict as opposed to trying to contain its consequences.
Thank you. Very clear, Christine. Mary?
Well, first on the integrated review, I very much agree with what Christine said. And I do very much hope that conflict resolution is one of the top priorities and that the way of addressing it is through an approach which brings all the different tools together in the ways that we've suggested. Of course, what I'd really like to see would be a shift to human security. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's interesting that both NATO and the Ministry of Defence have established human security units. And I don't think they really quite have absorbed what that implies, but it means putting the protection of people everywhere, the security of Afghans, equal to the security of Brits. And I think that would be a hugely important step. I'd like to say something about your question about the state, because I do think that in some ways these changes may not be reversible. We may not, you know, we tend to think of the state as the apex of the kind of institution that we need. But I have a feeling we're at a critical juncture globally with COVID and all these other things happening. And I think we are globally going to have to move towards more global and regional organizations, as well as towards much greater decentralization. Mm-hmm. And that's been kind of speeded up in conflict zones. Mm-hmm. And so my feeling is we shouldn't be obsessed with reconstructing the state. We should be thinking about the ways in which we reconstruct the fragmented authorities and how they're integrated into a regional and global system. For me, that would be the way forward. And finally, I just wanted to say something about peace processes, because we've all talked about it. I think the implication of our work is, yes, time is very important, that we should think about peace processes rather than just peace agreements. But also those peace processes have to be multi-level and inclusive. Both Christine and us, both the Edinburgh programme and our programme, have been increasingly putting efforts into local agreements. And local agreements can be peace agreements, where they've got a civic logic, but they can also be war agreements involving armed groups and the political marketplace. Though on the whole, any agreement tends to be better than no agreement, but it's even that's not true. But my feeling is one of the problems, we've come across some great local agreements, and our quantitative data on Africa suggests that a UN presence makes those agreements more sustainable. But I think the real problem is that everybody's now going local and saying, let's focus on local agreements. But actually, what happens nationally matters hugely, and what happens globally. So it's connecting the levels, which is very key. And the other key thing is civicness, which we have, Charlie mentioned the Syria case, where we were able to push for a civil society room in parallel. And there was also a women's advisory group. And just involving civic groups does change the nature of the conversation in a hugely important way. So, you know, so there are lots and lots of, as it were, lessons for the different tools. And I just gave you the example of peace processes, but we could think of others as well.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I just wanted to congratulate everyone who's been involved in the conflict research program, because I think the conversation has already shown the richness of your findings and the relevance for contemporary challenges. And I'm going to hand over the chair to Mary now, who'll preside over the Q&A.
Great. Thank you so much, Manoush, for coming.
Pleasure.
It's great to have you.
Pleasure.
Bye. And now we're going to have questions. From the floor. I'm trying to look at which questions we are focusing on. Sorry, everybody. I haven't had time to look at them all. But I know there was one question which I've just read, which I'm going to ask first, which was that we talk about the logics of what happens inside war zones, but we don't talk about the logics of intervention, and isn't there a logic of interventions, which I very much agree about, actually. We talk about the logics of all levels, but rather than answering that question myself, I'll put it to Alex.
Actually, I was rather hoping to hear what you had to say on that, on that, Mary. I think there is an assumption among on those who intervene that they will sort of be above and outside domestic politics in the countries in which they operate. But almost inevitably they become part of that system, for good or ill. And there's there's realities on both sides of good and ill, in terms of some of the tangible short-term solutions that can be offered by interveners, and some of the longer-term ways in which they can provide opportunities for stability in the development of civicness. And I'll just give one quick example, but then I also want to hear what Mary has to say on this, which is from South Sudan, where I think what the international intervention has done on the very much on the positive side is a handful of key measures that saved a lot of lives, such as the protection of civilian sites. It was the right thing to do, to allow people who were desperately in need of protection to flock into UN bases. Saved a lot of lives. The humanitarian assistance has also saved a lot of lives. But in the longer term, one of the interesting things about the international role is it provides a sort of internal place of asylum for civic actors who would otherwise be forced to leave the country or compromise with the authorities, but they find a place where they are both secured, personally secured, and actively involved within the international apparatus, be it the UN, be it the donors, be it the NGOs, and that's tremendously important. And And then, of course, they rotate back into politics, which, you know, and we may say that we may regret that. But nonetheless, it's much better to have these sorts of actors still present within a very, very troubling context like South Sudan.
I will add something just because Alex asked me to. But I think there's a huge difference between multilateral interventions undertaken under a UN umbrella, and I think I would also count the EU as a multilateral intervention, and interventions that are what one might call geopolitical, like the Iranian intervention in and Russian interventions in Syria, or even the Western interventions against ISIS, which weren't within a multilateral framework, even though there was a big coalition of the willing. So I think multilateralism is very important. And then the question is, how do you know what's civic and who decides what's civic? It's difficult, obviously, although some of us feel it's something you ought to be able to understand. But I think undeniably what's hugely important is to involve civilians. There is a tendency on the part of the international community, including all the multilateral actors, to think you have to talk to the armed groups because they're the ones that have to end the violence. And of course, that's true. But that doesn't mean you should neglect the civilians. It's hugely important to talk to tribal and religious leaders, to talk to women, to talk to youth, to talk to doctors, nurses, teachers. So, and they have to be involved and have to help inform. And of course, it's also terribly important to talk to local analysts, to talk to local researchers, to talk to people who've studied the conflict. So I think, you know, what counts as a legitimate intervention has very much to do with the multilateralism, and what makes an intervention civic very much has to do with the link with civilians. I mean, a very nice example of an international civic intervention, actually, it's a non-state intervention, is one of the stories that's come up. We have a special issue of a journal on civicness, and one of the articles is about journalism in Iraq, and there's a journalist who was able to expose corruption in Iraq by partnering with The Guardian on the publication of the Panama Papers. It's just a very nice, without that international engagement, it wouldn't have been possible. I don't know whether Charlie or Christine would like to add. Would you like to come in, Charlie, as an intervener?
I think I was just going to say that I think earlier on we were talking quite a lot about humanitarian intervention, but obviously it isn't. The political marketplace does relate to all different types of interventions, I think that while any while we're saying that everybody needs to think carefully about the political marketplace and how their interaction engages with it, there definitely are quite specific risks around different types of interventions. So I think a lot of the political marketplace research that Alex has done on the humanitarian sector kind of raises a number of those, particularly around things like food distribution systems and so forth. But equally, the research on the security and justice sector and the What Works paper that I know is coming out shortly looks quite specifically around the role of different security actors and interventions in that sphere, particularly around the transitions around DDR and so forth as well. So I think there are some kind of broader lessons around different areas of intervention that the research kind of brings out that I think will be useful to policymakers.
And Christine, did you want to come in?
Maybe not specifically on that. So I got a bit distracted by looking at all the questions coming in. They're very interesting. I suppose there's a strand of questions that I think it relates to around people asking in different ways. Should you play the political marketplace or sort of avoid it and destroy it? I think it was kind of Manush's question as well. And I suppose the lesson I take is that the political marketplace will exist, so you have to engage with it. It's not maybe a matter of playing or not playing it. Yeah.
The next question I want to put to people is a lovely question, and I certainly have answers. I'm thinking quite close to home, actually. Do CRP research findings apply to difficult or fragile situations beyond hot conflict areas? Can some of the findings apply to contexts without warfare? And I'm thinking of many of the contemporary authoritarian populist regimes, but even really close to home, the combination of Brexit and crony capitalism, it can be observed. But I will again, I'm going to go straight to Christine for this one.
Well, yes, I know you're coming to me, you know, I have an answer, but I mean, I think that what's really interesting is in some senses that if you look at those forces and political marketplace, and identity politics, I suppose, is the obvious one. These are becoming sort of quite key things that are driving politics and political responses, maybe more than, you know, this traditional idea of politics as being about choice and that people change their choice. And I think for me, this is the crucial difference, right? Whenever between identity politics and the politics of political choice, that it's, if people vote on a head count based on what group they understand themselves to be in, and if the lines between those groups are mutually reinforcing across lots of dimensions, then the normal assumptions that, you know, you present a political platform, people vote for it. If they don't like you, they vote you out, you amend your political platform, you go into competition, these don't really apply. And I think that's really in ways what CRP work saying is showing how that those assumptions don't apply, and in their place there's a different set of assumptions. And I think what's quite sort of disturbing maybe is how much this is, you know, when we think about decolonizing research, there's different ways of doing it. But I have seen people even on Twitter saying recently, maybe we need to you know, learn from how the Global South has dealt with certain problems and how it has tackled something like populism, right? Which has been seen as a more an issue in maybe in the Global South and the Global North, but now seems a really relevant issue for the Global North. So I think that if you look at those forces are there in any society, and societies all vary in how they play out. But in some senses, by providing tools for how we reckon with them, I think our tools really ultimately in ways about how you deal with the divisions that are really deep and that seem to be ones that are not amenable to political persuasion and political choice. So if your sense of being in a group and of your identity politics is not really amenable to political choice, then, you know, there has to be a different way of engaging with that. I mean, where we, you know, so in some ways, even, you know, without getting too controversial, it's been really interesting to me during the Brexit period to see how identities of Remainers or Leavers has sort of almost started on occasion, and not necessarily irrevocably or forever, but it has started to take on an almost identity politics. You know, does it start to line up with anti-maskers and pro-maskers or anti-vaccine? No, not, of course, not completely. And with any luck, it wouldn't. But you can see that in places where lots of different senses that certain things really define for all time who you are and who your tribe is, not using that in that really general sense that we're all members of tribes of one sort or another. I think it does have learning for that. Does that mean that we're all in the same place? No. Does it mean that understanding how where these dynamics play? I suppose the big difference is, and I mean, this is true, but this notion that there's an adherence to norms and a civic commitment. I think that's what I like about civicness, is not just a sort of way of being or a nice word for peace, but as by saying a sort of set of informal commitments. That actually what we find is that if people are prepared to throw those commitments out, even in stable societies, it's often informal commitments of civicness and good behaviour that determine whether the institutions are going to be resilient or not. Really, really, only at these rare, difficult moments. But I mean, we think we've seen that play out in America. You know, is it the institutions and the constitution that saves America if somebody who's elected didn't quit power? Or is it what the normative sensibilities of his fellow politicians were in that moment and how they would choose to articulate those publicly? So of course what we see is all those things are important, that the institutions can't save something where that sensibility is left, even in a settled society. And likewise, without the institutions, it can be difficult to find the leverage and the vehicles for that.
Have on the department's ability to positively influence conflict. Mm-hmm. And you sort of knew you were going to get it.
Yeah, sorry, something jumped for me there.
Oh, did it jump for everybody else? Can you hear me, everybody?
Yeah. Can now.
Okay, great. So sorry. For Charlie, did you hear the question, Charlie?
Ah, right. Sorry, Mary. I wasn't quite sure if that was coming to me or not. Can you just repeat it?
Yeah. What impact would the FCDO aid cut have on the department's ability to positively influence conflict? Sorry.
So, yes, let me just have a quick think about this. So one of the things that we've talked about earlier, so clearly resources are going to be more constrained. But I think it is important that we don't always equate more resources with necessarily us being more effective. It definitely helps because it massively opens up the options of who and what you can support. But I do think that what the political marketplace is making us reflect on is hard, is whether is in what context those resources could be applied in a way that doesn't feed into this negative cycle of transactional politics. And if we can be more careful and thoughtful in how we use our resources and our people to engage in these contexts in light of that, then I think that's what will make the difference to our approach. Resources are always helpful, but it's not just about resources that is going to make the difference, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, resources can feed, as we've argued, can feed into the political marketplace, and sometimes it's politics that matter. So I do think the aid cut is horrible, but at the same time, I do think it might focus our minds on how to operate in these conflict situations. I'm going to go on to the next question, which I'm going to address to Alex. What are the long-term effects of economic sanctions on peace processes? How efficient are sanctions as a tool to promote change?
Good question. And actually, they're one of our collaborators, researchers in on the program, Ben Spatz, is really the specialist on this. I think we can distinguish two sorts of sanctions here. One is the old style economic sanctions on a whole country, which are quite rare now, though we see them on Iran. And then there are the tool of targeted sanctions, which are increasingly common, which include asset freezes, travel bans, and other sanctions that are targeted at individual members of a political elite. Now, in the first, the general sanctions, what we tend to see is that if you prohibit legitimate economic activity, you drive a lot of key elite activity run by well-connected people in government, you drive it into the shadows, and therefore you entrench a political market. And this is what we've seen time and again in different countries. So you can put a lot of pressure on a country like Sudan, but the one of the outcomes of that is that when change comes in Sudan, you find you're up against a mafia style crony capitalist network entrenched in a lot of very, very nasty networks that's very, very difficult to uproot. On the individually targeted sanctions, I think here we, this is an unexplored area, but it's an area in which the political marketplace framework toolkit becomes a very useful tool, because immediately you then need to understand, you have a mechanism, a tool for understanding how individual members of political elites or groups, factions, are likely to behave if they are cut off from their external assistance and so on. So you can see how strategies may change. We had a very interesting discussion, for example, on Yemen, and one of the interesting conjectures, it wasn't proven, that arose from this was when Ali Abdullah Saleh was cut off from his own sources of political finance, he was then forced to make other different political alliances, in this case with the Houthis, that had unexpected consequences for those who imposed the sanctions, but which were actually quite predictable if you used a political marketplace toolkit. I won't go on, but we can begin to explore this, and at the moment we don't have general answers.
Thanks. And actually, there's another question to you, and I'm going to ask that, and then we might think about some summaries. Are there examples, cases, studies of where external actors have responded effectively to the political marketplace? Have we got any examples?
In the narrow sense, I don't think we do, because I don't think the political marketplace framework has been used in a sufficiently clear and transparent manner for us to be able to say, okay, this is an intervention designed to achieve A, B, and C on the basis of this analysis. We're not at that stage yet. That said, I think there are a number of cases in which, because it is a sort of intuitively resonant a framework that has been already adopted by a number of actors on the ground, for example, in refining conflict analysis. So I understand from another researcher that we have more recently enlisted on this program, Chris Newton, who has worked in South Sudan, that in his work in anticipating how food crises would develop in the context of conflict and the war economy in South Sudan, the political marketplace framework has been a useful tool in understanding those dynamics.
There's so many questions that we can so I'm going to ask a final ending question. There are lots of other questions that have come up, and I'm really sorry for people that we there are numerous good questions, and anybody who's looking at the Q&A can look at the questions, but they're questions on humanitarian aid. There's a question about the role of Russia and China, which is really difficult to answer, but is really important, and their role in generating rents. And there are various other questions, but this a possible closing question, and we could go round all four of us, are what are the recurring blind spots that keep policymakers from seeing patterns in their handling of conflict resolution? It's a good question for us all to end on. And maybe on this one, I will start with Charlie.
I think
I'm putting you on the spot.
Recurring, I'd like to think that this is helping us overcome blind spots. I think when you look back at the approaches of the international community to conflict over the last sort of couple of decades, you can see quite a big shift that shows how a lot of the, so even if we think back to the state building of sort of approaches of the 90s, there were big sets of assumptions around how services would contribute to stability per se. And I think that I think a lot of the research over the last sort of few years has really shown that it's highly dependent on which actors are delivering services, how they're delivering them, how different other communities relate to those services. And I'm really glad to see that there is a big shift in this kind of thinking happening in the community. And it doesn't mean that the blind spots totally go away. The question around examples of how we have tackled, how policymakers have tackled these difficult challenges well, I think there are quite a lot of them, even if people might not want to always talk about them openly. Certainly, it seems that a lot of the political marketplace relates to our understanding of risk and how we make decisions on who we want to work with, and where we can see that we're working through systems that might be being co-opted by political actors in ways that we might not have intended. So quite often we can start off working in one particular way, but over time other actors will seek to try and co-opt the resources that we are providing, and we have to stay really astute, I think, to make sure that doesn't happen. But I do think that there are kind of ways of trying to do that. But as we've discussed, it takes a lot of resource and thinking and understanding to really understand how those to stay on top of all of the detail of those changes that are happening at local, national, and international levels on an enduring basis.
Thanks. I'll go to Alex next.
Thank you. Let me give an example of how I think these blind spots play out by using the case of Ethiopia today. Because I think there was a blind spot among the international community that the process of the liberalization of an authoritarian system could be taken at face value, that the stated good intention of those who were leading this liberalization could be accepted without bringing to bear our framework of, first of all, saying that what one would expect from such a deregulation of politics is the growth of transactional politics in the sense of a political marketplace, and that a democratic movement that was framed in terms of a movement of civic nationalism, it was led by Oromo leaders, wouldn't then be instrumentalized in terms of a much more aggressive ethno-nationalist movement, set of tendencies, which were always latent, which could always be instrumentalized there. But that combination would happen, and I think there was a blind spot in the international community. And there was the third element of this blind spot was that a peace agreement should be taken also at face value, in this case, a peace agreement between Ethiopia and Eritrea, where the Eritrean leader, Isaias Afwerki, is the specialist in another form of transactional politics, which is elimination. I mean, and this is how he has conducted his political business as usual for more than 20 years, and which he is continuing to do today. So what we have in Ethiopia is a particularly toxic mix of a political marketplace in Addis, highly aggressive, exclusionary identity politics, and the politics of extermination pursued by the Eritrean leader, and I will single him out as an individual. And this came about, this was allowed to happen through blind spots, inadvertent or deliberate, but I think form a rather accentuated version, exaggerated perhaps version of common blind spots in our international system.
Okay, thank you. Christine.
Hi. I think for me, a blind spot is sort of understanding elite deals and then broader inclusion and norms as these two very different things. And that, you know, I think even when they're both supported, they're sometimes supported as they're just two really different things that don't connect. I think understanding that, bringing them together, I think means understanding that whatever deal you sign between elites will face this ongoing gaming and will face obstacles down the road. And that really there's going to need to be a whole set of broader actors in place to help the deal over the bumps in the road. And whether people believe in the deal, whether they're prepared to weigh and support it, whether they're prepared to leverage their political leaders to comply with it to some degree, is going to be quite important to sustaining it. So I think I sort of see lots of times that there is, even in contexts where there's a lot of support for inclusion of civil society, of women, and, you know, promotion of human rights norms, it's sort of seen as, it's this kind of icing on the cake, and when the going gets tough, we can just bunker down and cut another deal and that stuff can fall by the wayside. I think understanding that it's instrumental to the deal and to making the deal better than it might otherwise be. So I think that for me is a blind spot. Maybe I'll just leave it there.
Oh, well, thank you. And I think I want to mention three blind spots. I think they all emerge out of a mindset that sees conflict in very old-fashioned terms, kind of the model of past wars, rather than trying to understand as we're trying to explain war as a social condition. But what are the three blind spots? I think one blind spot is identity politics. I think in our paper that we did for our special issue, me and Alex said that it was a zombie concept, the idea of ancient hatreds. You know, when people start reporting on Syria, they tell us that there's this long historical division between Shia and Sunni, which simply isn't true. It's something that was constructed through conflict and can be deconstructed. And even though every academic that writes about identity politics says that identity politics is constructed, the idea of ancient hatreds emerges time and time again in every international effort to solve conflict. So that's one of the blind spots I get very irritated by. A second blind spot is justice. And that's something that it gives me a chance to mention, because it's something that comes out of our research, how hugely important justice is for people. And how these are conflicts in which the elites are basically criminals. They're criminals in classic war criminal terms because they've violated international humanitarian law or they've violated human rights law, but they're also criminals in economic terms. And in the end, these conflicts will never be resolved unless you get rid of impunity. And there's a tendency on the part of the international community to think peace comes first and justice comes after. And I just am very against that. I think it's terribly important to start thinking about justice and thinking about how you promote effective justice systems. And in our research, what really comes out is the huge importance of legal activism. Very important in South Sudan, but we also find the collection of documentary evidence in Syria is hugely important and something that needs supporting. And then the third blind spot, which is sort of obvious, I guess, is our own role in the conflicts. These are globalized conflicts. They depend, as Alex has made clear, on global finance. The success of elites depends on their being able to invest, say, in London. And you can probably track the rise of property prices in London to Syrian war criminals or Russian oligarchs. And so the role of London in money laundering is very central to the continuation of these conflicts. So, you know, and we can think of lots of other examples. The obvious example is arms sales, not just because they might directly contribute to war, as in the case of Yemen, but also because they're absolutely perfect for bribery and corruption and are one of the key factors in the political marketplace. If you want to know why a country like Uganda or South Sudan, which use pickup trucks for actual fighting, want to buy sophisticated armaments, it's because it's a source of bribery. So I'm putting this very bluntly, but those are three examples, I think, of the kind of blind spots we need to address, which reflect, I think, an overall failure to sort of understand the nature of these conflicts. So I suppose our message above all is, and that's for the integrated review for tomorrow, is that we need the UK to act in civic ways in the future. So thank you very much to everybody who came. And I also want to say a big thank you to the whole CRP team. I've no idea how many of them are here watching or listening. But anyway, it's been a great journey the last 4 years. And many, many particular thanks to Charlie, who's been our officer in the Foreign Office and who's bravely answered the difficult questions today. So thanks to everybody. And I think we can end it here.